of Sfiras HaOmer, and we've been talking about various aspects of the halachic difficulties and issues that we have when we approach Sfiras HaOmer. So today we're going to talk about a different aspect of Sfira, and that is the counting that we do. And how is this similar to other countings that we find in our mitzvah experiences throughout the year? There are a number of places where we find that we have an obligation, that we have a mitzvah to keep a count. And the question is, are they all similar? Are they different? And how can we learn one from the other? So let's begin with the first count, and that is the Sfiras Shmitin V'Yovlin, which I imagine probably most of us have never even heard of. And the reason why we never heard of it is because we do not keep that count nowadays any longer. So let's just begin by way of introduction with that. We have a seven-year cycle. You have a farmer who grows some sort of produce, some sort of crop in Israel, so there's a seven-year cycle of what they are supposed to do with those crops. We're all familiar with trumas, with maaseros. That's something. You go shopping in Costco and they're selling Jaffa oranges, you have a concern, maybe they didn't, what do you do? Maybe they didn't take off the trumas and maaseros. So trumas and maaseros is something that every single year a farmer must separate from the crops. If you don't separate it from the crops, you have a real problem, and even those of us who are not the farmers, if we go ahead and buy those crops from them and trumas and maaseros have not been separated, we also have a problem as well. But outside of the trumas and maaseros, we have a seven-year cycle. The seven-year cycle culminates in what we know as Shemitah. In Shemitah, you're not allowed to plow the lands, you're not allowed to work the fields at all. And before the 7 years, we have a six-year cycle leading up to the Shemitah. In years number 1, 2, 4, and 5, you have to give what we call Maaser Sheni, which means you have to separate some of the crops and bring them up to Yerushalayim. In years 3 and 6, you have to separate Maaser Ani in the place of Maaser Sheni, which means you separate a certain amount, give it away to the poor people. So that's basically the cycle. After you have the 6 years of Maaser Sheni and Maaser Ani, then you have the 7th year, which is a blank. You don't give anything because you're not supposed to be working the field. So that's called Shemitah. After you keep a 7 year cycle, then you have to keep a cycle of 7 times 7, which is going to culminate in Yovel. What happens in the Yovel in the Jubilee year? We know that Yovel, the Avadim go free, all of the slaves go free. Doesn't matter when they became your slave, if they just became the slave a year ago or they became the slave 49 years ago. Either way, we assume the slave goes free in the 50th year. The major question in the Rishonim, how exactly you calculate the 50th year? Do you count 7, 7, 7, 7, and then year 49 is both a Shemitah year and a Yovel year? Or do you count 7, 7, 7, and then year 49 is Shemitah, and year 50 is a Yovel, and then year 51 is the first for the next count? That's a big discussion in the Rishonim, not really relevant to our story right now. But let's look at the Pasuk in Parshas Bahar, where we find a very similar phraseology to the pasuk that we have by the mitzvah of Sfiras HaOmer. By the mitzvah of Sfiras HaOmer, we're told, "Usfartam lachem mimacharas haShabbos," as we said last week. You have to begin to count. Mimacharas haShabbos means after the first day of Pesach. Tisperu chamishim yom. Sheva Shabbos as tmimus tmiyena. You have to count 7 weeks, 49 days. That is the mitzvah of Sfiras HaOmer. Look at the pasuk, which is pretty much a parallel in Parshas Bahar, where we're told, Usfarta lacha sheva shabbos shanim. You have to count 7 years. Sheva shanim sheva pamim. 7 years, 7 different times. V'hayu lacha yemei sheva shabbos hashanim teisha v'arba'im shana. So we have an obligation. The same way we count Sfiras HaOmer, 7 weeks, 7 days, so too we have an obligation to count 7 times the Shemitah cycle and lead up in the culmination of a Yovel, which is going to be in year 50. And there's a discussion in the Rishonim as to what exactly the nature of that mitzvah is. Some Rishonim say, we don't have to actually call out and make any proclamation, declaration, and say, this year is 3, this year is year 4, this year is year 5. That's not necessary. All we need to do is make sure that the Beis Din, who's in charge of this is not an obligation that we all have individually to keep account and know what we're up to. The Beis Din, as the, I guess, the emissaries of all of us, they're the ones who have to keep account. But they do not have to make any proclamation. That's what some Rishonim say. There's no real mitzvah. It's just that they should know when the Yovel is. And then there are other Rishonim who say, no, this is an actual mitzvah. A bracha should be recited. This is a real mitzvah. The same way we have a mitzvah of Sfiras HaOmer, so too we have a mitzvah of Sfiras HaShmita VaHayovel, the beginning of every year. They convene on the first day of the year. They get up and they say, this year is year 3. This year is year 4. This year is year 5. And then they keep the count until ultimately they get to a Shemitah. In fact, the Sefer Achinuch, when he talks about this mitzvah of counting the Shemitah and the Yovel cycle, he says it's a direct parallelism to the mitzvah of Sfiras HaOmer. And he says the same way that by Sfira one has to count both the days and the weeks and know exactly where we're up to, So too, when it comes to the Sfiras HaShemitah VaYovel, we do the very same. Listen to the way the Sefer HaChinuch explains. What do you say when you get to year 8, let's say? So he says, the Bezdin gets up and makes a proclamation, which is exactly the same as the proclamation that we make on day 8 of the Sfira. By the way, today is day 24, for those who are still with us. So, the Sefer HaChinuch writes, on year 8, you say, Hayom Shmoa Shanim, today is 8 years, Shehem Shmita Achas V'Shana Achas LiYovel. Right, which is very similar to the way we would count Sfira. Hayom Shmona Yamin, what would we say? Today is the 8th day, which is 1 week and 1 day in the counting of 49 days. So too over here, you say, Hayom Shmona Shanim, today is the start of the 8th year, which is 1 Shemitah and 1 year leading up to the next Yovel. So that's basically the mitzvah of keeping an account of the Shemitah and the Yovel. And the reason why it's not so relevant is, number one, because it's not an individual obligation. This is an obligation that we have communally, just as the Beis Din does it on behalf of all of us, but we do not have an individual obligation like we find by Sfiras HaOmer. And number two, the reason why it doesn't apply is because the Gemara tells us that the only time we have to keep account of the Shemitah and the Yovel cycle is when we have Kol Yosheveha Aleha, when we have most of the Jewish people living in the land of Israel, which we do not have nowadays. They say that we're almost up to there, but we do not have that nowadays, and therefore Yovel doesn't apply, Shemitah doesn't really apply. So you'll say, what do you mean Shemitah doesn't apply? We keep a Shemitah, don't we? The answer is, Shemitah b'zman hazeh is only midrabanan. Shemitah nowadays is only midrabanan, it's only rabbinic. This is why we find many leniencies when it comes to Shemitah. Let's say the whole Heter Mechira, right? We have a big controversy whether or not we should be following the Heter Mechira. The whole premise of why we can even think about doing a Heter Mechira is because, since Shemitah nowadays is only midrabanan, and it's so difficult for the farmer to make a living, and we have major problems, so therefore, we go ahead and we do a Heter Mechira. But had Shemitah nowadays been a mitzvah d'oraisa, we would not be allowed to do this loophole to get around the laws of Shemitah. Shemitah nowadays is only midrabanan. So that's one count that we find, which is the count of Shemitah and Yovel, something that's not really relevant nowadays. Hopefully it should be relevant soon. And also, it's something that is not an individual obligation, it's something which is a communal obligation that the Beis Din takes care of on our behalf. The second count that we find, outside of Sfiras HaOmer, is the mitzvah of counting Shiva Nekiyim. A woman who is a Nida, she wants to become Tehora, has to count Shiva Nekiyim, 7 clean days, in order to be able to go to the mikvah and become Tehora once again. The Zohar HaKadosh writes in Parshas Tetzaveh a very fascinating comment where he says, the same way that a woman has to count 7 days Shiva Nekiyim in order to be able to go to the mikvah, so too we as the Jewish people need to count 7 weeks in order to enable ourselves to become Tehorim, to accept the Torah. So it's a direct parallelism between Shiva Nekiyim and the 7 weeks that we count of the Sfira, because we're enabling ourselves to be worthy of accepting the Torah. And once again, over here, we find a major discussion in the Rishonim. What exactly are the parameters of this mitzvah of Shiva Nekiyim? What exactly does that mean? Whereas we find the Rishonim disagreeing by Shvita and Yovel counting, is it an actual mitzvah, or is it just that we have to keep in the back of our minds where we're up to? So too over here, the Ramban says, there is no mitzvah for a woman every day to write down on the calendar, this is what we're up to, I'm on day one, I'm on day two. No, as long as you know where you're up to, where you're going, where you're headed, how many days you have left, and how many you've done already, that's good enough. There is no actual mitzvah to count the days of Shiva Nekiyim. That's the way the Ramban and the Sefer HaChinuch describe the mitzvah of Visafrala, which is also a very similar kind of terminology that we find by these other mitzvahs. Visafrala means the woman has an obligation, a mitzvah to count. What exactly does that mean? Does it mean she actually has to count? Or does it mean she just has to know where she's up to? So let's look at a Tosas and Maseches Ksubas, Daf Ayin Beis Amud Aleph. And this is a very important fundamental Tosas where he says something that's going to take us into the next part of the shir. V'im Tomer. Tosas asks the following question. This is number Gimel on the Hebrew side of the sheet. V'im Tomer. Amai ein mevareches hazaba al sfirasa. We have a woman who's keeping account of Shiva Nekiyim. She wants to be able to go to the mikveh at the end of the week, and we know that she keeps account, so why does she not recite a bracha as she's keeping account? The same way when we count Sfiras HaOmer every night. We recite a bracha. Every night before we count, we recite a bracha. So too, every night before a woman takes count of what day she's up to in the Shiva Nekiyim, she should also recite a bracha. Now, what you see clearly, number one from Tosis, is that he's assuming that there's a mitzvah involved here. Otherwise, you don't recite a bracha on just doing something. So, right, if you're counting how many days it is to meditation, yes, it's very exciting, but I don't recite a bracha. So the assumption is that obviously if Tosis is asking the question, why do we not recite a bracha on counting Shiva Nekiyim, it must be he's assuming that there is obviously a mitzvah to keep a count. So he asked the following. Why don't we count with a bracha the same way we count Sfiras HaOmer? Doesn't it say V'Safra? The same way it says V'Svartam Lachem by Sfiras HaOmer, so too over here it says V'Safra La, that the woman has to keep a count. Shouldn't that be the same? It sounds like the same word. It sounds like the same thing. Why don't we have that obligation? So that's Tosis's question. There are those who want to say, well, it's a very nice question. However, there is no mitzvah for a woman to become tahora. There is no mitzvah. If a woman decides, I never want to go to the mikvah, let's say a woman is not married or doesn't have a husband or whatever it is, she doesn't have an obligation to go to the mikvah. So you'll say, there is no mitzvah to go and keep the count of Shivan Akiyim because she doesn't always have to do so. So therefore, perhaps that's the reason why we don't recite a bracha. That's not such a good answer. Why is it not a good answer? Because, take for example the mitzvah of Shechita. Right? We don't have an obligation to go ahead and slaughter animals all day long and go and eat meat. Yet, if we choose to go ahead and eat meat and slaughter an animal, we do have to recite a bracha, v'tzivanu al hashchita. So that should be the same. Yes, a woman doesn't have an obligation to go and become tahor, but if she chooses to go to the mikvah, this is the process that she's supposed to follow, and therefore in doing so, she should be reciting a bracha. The same way we would recite a bracha on the mitzvah of shchita, which also is not something that we're obligated to do, but if one wants to do so, this is the way to do it. So again, we come to the question of Tosis, why is it that by some mitzvahs of counting we recite a bracha, whereas by others we do not? So let's see his answer. V'yesh lomar. Right after the question mark, halfway through, v'yesh lomar. De'ein mevarchim ela biyovel. We only recite a bracha when we count the years of Shemitah and Yovel, as we started. Shemevarchim ha-bezdin mechal shana, that at the start of every year, the bezdin convenes, they recite a bracha, and they say, asher k'deshon mitzvos v'tzivanu al mitzvah smiras hashana, I don't know exactly what they say, and then they count the year. Shalaolam yuchal limnos keseder. Why? Because over there, every year we know the Bezdin can just follow what they did last year, and they can continue in the count that they already began. V'chein ha'omer, and the same goes with Sfiras HaOmer. Why do we recite a bracha on Sfiras HaOmer? Because every night you're able to continue on the count that you already started many days earlier. However, he says, Avol Zava, but when you have a woman who has a nidah cycle, Shem Tira Tister, yes, she might start counting day one, day two, day three, but how often do we know that something goes wrong somewhere in the middle, and then you have to start all over again? So, because it might be totally annulled, it might be totally disqualified halfway through, therefore, how can you recite a bracha? The Sfiras HaOmer, where we know, you start counting the beginning, you'll be able to make it through the end, you recite it every night. But the Sfiras Shivan Akiyim, how can you recite a bracha if it might stop in the middle? We know that very often it gets stopped in the middle, and therefore we assume that a bracha would not be recited. So again, Tosis is of the opinion that there is a mitzvah for a woman to count. However, a bracha is not recited because often it's going to get cut short in the middle and you're going to have to start again. You're going to invalidate the count that was already began. And therefore, there's no reason to recite a bracha. The Shalach HaKadosh took this a step further and he said, not only is there a mitzvah for a woman to keep a count, and not only should we consider perhaps reciting a bracha, if not for the consideration that Tosis tells us, he says, a woman has an obligation, just like Sfiras HaOmer, to count verbally, to actually pronounce every day. Today is day one. Today is day two. And the Nodeb Yehuda and others made fun of the Shalah, and they said, what is he talking about? He's inventing a whole new mitzvah. Look at the Nodeb Yehuda. This is interesting. The Nodeb Yehuda writes as follows. Omer Ani, Hagon HaKadosh Hazeh. This Shalah, who is a great tzaddik, a great Taman Chacham, a Gon VaHaKadosh, Lerov Kidushasa V'Chasiduso, because he is so holy and because he is such a exalted individual, Niskayimbo Ohiv Mitzvos Lo Yisba Mitzvos. What that means is we have a pasuk in Tanakh which tells us, Ohiv Kesef Lo Yisba Kesef. Somebody who's money hungry will never be satisfied. You're always going to want more, you're always going to have an opportunity to make more, and you'll never be happy in life because Ohiv Kesef Lo Yisba Kesef. It's never enough. So they have a play on the words and they say, Ohiv Mitzvos, somebody who loves Mitzvos feels that 613 is not enough. Lo Yisba Mitzvos. We've got to make up some more, make up new ones. So over here, that's what the Nodeb Yehuda says. Because the Shalah was such a holy individual, he wasn't satisfied with the 613 mitzvahs the way they are, so he had to make up a new mitzvah. And he says, not only do we have to keep 613, we also have to make up a new one that a woman has to keep a count verbally every day to keep the count of Shivan Akiyim and articulate what day she's actually up to. That's not what we assume. We assume that you just have to keep the count to know where you're up to, and to ultimately go to the mikvah. But again, Tosis says the reason why we don't recite a bracha is because this is something that very often can be can be destroyed. As Tosa says, Shema Tira Tister, if the woman will have some sort of problem along the way, everything will be disqualified, everything will be annulled from what was done in the previous day. So let's go, based on that assumption, let's go look at other cases and see whether or not they are similar. We have on a public fast day. So there's one thing that we insert into the Shemona Esrei on a public fast day. What do we insert? Anenu. Anenu is a special paragraph that we recite when we have a fast day. When do we recite that paragraph? At which point in the Shemona Esrei? Well, that depends. If you're an individual person davening, then you recite the Tefillah Vanenu by Shema Koleinu. In the middle of Shema Koleinu, you insert a whole other paragraph. If you happen to be the Chazan, then you recite the Bracha. It's a separate Bracha in Shemona Esrei. You recite it in between the Bracha of Re'eva Anyenu and Rifa'enu. There's a whole reason why it's put there, but basically the Chazan recites a separate Bracha. The Gaonim were of the opinion that we should recite Anenu in all the prayers that we daven throughout the Tainus Tzibur, throughout the public fast day. We are fasting today. This is something that's an insertion. The same way we recite Yalla V'Yavo on Rosh Chodesh for all the Tefillah, so to Anenu should be recited throughout the entire Tefillah, throughout the entire day when we daven on a public fast day. However, we do not assume that way. We do not assume that you should recite Anenu by Shachris. Why? Because you don't know if you're going to end up finishing up the fast. So it wouldn't make sense to say, Anenu Hashem biyom tzom taniseinu, please answer us on our day of mourning, on our day of fasting, if in fact you might not fast the rest of the day. It's going to be dover shkurim, you're going to say a lie. Please answer us on the day that I'm fasting, you're not really fasting. Because maybe you're going to break it. So therefore by Shachris we do not do it. However, by Mincha, we do recite Anenu. We do have the practice to recite Anenu. And the reason for that is because you're in the middle of fasting, so therefore you should recite Anenu. Ask the Radvaz. The Radvaz was living in the 1400s, early 1500s. He points out, why aren't we concerned? You daven mincha at 3 o'clock on a fast day. You recite Anenu because you're still fasting. Maybe at 5, 6 o'clock, certainly now when Shkia is so late, it's going to be 7:30 till you're able to eat, 8 o'clock. Well then, aren't we concerned that maybe from 3 o'clock to 8 o'clock, you're going to have to break your fast? So why should we even recite Anenu if you daven mincha on a fast day? Right? Is that a good question? The same way we don't recite it in Shachris because maybe you won't finish off. Why should we recite it in Mincha? Maybe you won't finish off. So again, if you're davening Mincha 10 minutes before Shkia, it makes sense. We understand. But we know that you're allowed to start davening Mincha at 1 o'clock already. So from 1 o'clock to 7 o'clock, a lot of things can happen. Things can go wrong. Maybe you won't be feeling well. And therefore, you'll have to break the fast that happens. So why is it that we recite Anenu if we don't recite it in Shachris? Why do we recite it in Mincha? And the answer, the Radvaz first says is, well, as long as you made it halfway through the day, even if you break it afterward, you can still say, well, I fasted today, something. If you say it in Shachris, let's say you say it at 7 o'clock in the morning. I don't know what time everyone davens in the morning, but let's say you daven at 7 o'clock in the morning, and then at 10 o'clock you break your fast. Well, that wouldn't make any sense because that means you didn't really fast. You just ate a late breakfast. Instead of eating breakfast at 9, you ate breakfast at 10. If I fasted already till 1 o'clock in the afternoon, now I daven mincha, and then ultimately after break it, you can still say, I did fast today. I didn't eat like I normally would have. It's not that I ate a late lunch and a late breakfast. You fasted till half the day, and therefore maybe it still makes sense to say Anenu. But then he says this is also not a good reason to assume why we should say Anenu on a fast day during Mincha, because the Nusach that we say, the paragraph is written Biyom Tzom Taniseinu, which means we fast on the entire day of the public fast. So it still doesn't make sense. How can you say, I'm going to fast the entire day of the fast day, meanwhile, you might not make it through? So why is it that we're not concerned by a fast day as well? The same way Tosa says, a woman wouldn't recite a bracha on Shiva Nikiyim because maybe something's going to go wrong and it will disqualify everything she's done. Well, so too over here, why do we recite on Anenu if maybe it can disqualify the entire tefillah because maybe I'll have to go eat later on? So the answer that's given by the Pri Chadash, by the Chok Yaakov, so far so good? The answer that's given by the Pri Chadash, by the Chok Yaakov is, yes, it's true. Every once in a while a person has to break their fast, but 90% of the times, we're going to be okay. So again, if you're somebody who knows that they're going to have to break it because you're on medications and because it's not healthy for you, so you're not fasting, so you don't say Anenu. But if you're somebody who generally makes it through, and yes, once in a blue moon something goes wrong, you don't feel well, you have a headache, you have something, and you have to eat or drink on the fast, and you're not going to make it through, so okay. But that's the exception to the rule. So because 90% of the times, most of the times, it's going to work out the way you plan, therefore, Anenu can be recited. However, by the Shiva Nikiyim, where there's a high likelihood that something might go wrong, that happens very often, therefore we assume a bracha is not recited. So the basic principle is, wherever there's a high likelihood, wherever it's probable that something will go wrong, a bracha is not recited. However, when we assume that, in all likelihood, this is what's going to happen, like by a fast, 90% of the people make it through the fast. They don't have an issue in the middle, unless they're sick, and unless they know in advance that there's something wrong. But 90% of the healthy people know that there's nothing to be concerned of. Yes, it's going to be uncomfortable, but they probably will make it through. So in a case like that, we do recite a bracha. Yeah. Why? No, but the question is, again, isn't there a difference between an individual reciting a bracha and a collective tzibur reciting a bracha? It's a good point, however, but what about my individual Shemana Esrei? So yes, it's true. As far as the tzibur is concerned, there's a major discussion. What if I'm the chazan? I have the best voice in the tzibur, so they want me to daven on the tainus. However, I'm not fasting. It happens every so often. You have somebody who can't fast, but they happen to be the best chazan, so they put them up. Is that right? Should they say Anenu if they personally are not fasting? Well, on the other hand, you'll say, you're not saying it on your behalf. You're saying it on behalf of everybody else. So that's a discussion. But what about my private Shemona Esrei? My private Shemona Esrei is the same as my private counting of Sfiras HaOmer, of Shiva Nikiyim. It's the same thing. So that's the question. Why isn't that the same? And the answer is because there's a high likelihood that something will go wrong by Shiva Nikiyim, but there's a very low chance of something going wrong on a public fast day. This really has very interesting roots in the Chasam Sofer as well. The Chasam Sofer has a fascinating discussion where he talks about the Gemara in Ksubas Daf Yad Aleph. The Gemara tells us about Ger Katam. So what's the process of conversion? Process of conversion is, if somebody takes classes and they know about Judaism, they know everything that there is to know, ultimately we know they can go to the mikvah and they can become Jews, right? They can be mekabel ol mitzvahs. One of the most important parts of being a Jew is one has to accept upon themselves that I want to follow all the mitzvahs in the Torah. Once they do that, and we have a firm belief that they're really going to do a good job at that, so then we can accept them as a convert, and now they're a full-fledged Jew. The question is, have you ever heard of somebody who adopts a child as a very young, as an infant? So you have a Jewish family that wants to adopt a child for whatever reason, but the child is an infant. So how do we go ahead and do a conversion on that kind of child? What do we do? How does that work? So the Gemara says that we have a right to convert a young child, even though the child is at a stage where they have no understanding about the mitzvahs. 6 months old. Often, let's say, I think Rav Moshe says, if I'm not mistaken, it's preferable to adopt from a non-Jewish family than to adopt from a Jewish family. Why? Because maybe down the line, often, the child doesn't know who the biological parents are, and maybe this family had boys and girls and everything, and they adopted them, they farmed them all out, and ultimately maybe a nice boy is going to marry a nice Jewish girl that's from a different family, not knowing that they happen to be brothers and sisters. So if you adopt from a non-Jewish family, you save yourself of those issues. You save yourself of those issues. However, when it comes to adoption, how are we able to convert a child if you adopt a non-Jewish child? How can we convert the child if the child has no understanding of anything? We convert the child at 6 months old when they do the adoption, or at 3 months old when they do the adoption. How can we go ahead and do such a thing if you're missing the most fundamental ingredient in the conversion? They're not taking the mitzvahs upon themselves. So the Gemara answers this question and says, Ger Katan, when you have a young child that goes to the mikvah to become a ger, and yes, it's a very frightening experience when you have to put a three-month-old baby totally submerged underwater. It's a very, very dangerous and scary thing to do. So sometimes they wait till the child's a little older. They always go in with an adult, don't worry. But basically, it's a frightening kind of experience. But that's just the mikvah part. What about the most important part of accepting all the mitzvahs upon themselves? So the Gemara says, well, we have a principle, Zachin la'adam shelo b'fanav, which means, if we project into the future that this is advantageous for this child to be growing up in a religious home, living by these principles, being kept in a school where they're really going to teach them all the Torah mitzvahs, and having all of that lifestyle that we all know very well, then we have a right to accept it on the child's behalf because we know that it's something that's to their benefit. But take for example, unfortunately, we have these kinds of shilas that come up all the time now, and we have to be aware of it. We have, which is against the Torah, not getting political now, but you have gay and lesbian couples in all of our communities. So we're not here to judge. Whatever they do, they do. But the question arises, often they want to adopt a child. So what do? How can we convert a child to be raised in a home where you have a gay or a lesbian parent? So again, it's not that we as a community are judging the couple. But you take, for example, is it really advantageous for the kid to be growing up in a home like that? That's subject to a major debate. Are the schools going to let the kid enroll in the school? It's a major question. Not all the schools are comfortable with it. So we cannot say with certainty that this is going to be advantageous to the child to be growing up in a home like that. Or you take, for example, you have a totally unaffiliated couple. Not that this is similar at all to the other case I just mentioned, but you have a couple who doesn't keep the Torah mitzvahs. So can we really say, as a responsible Beis Din, can we really say it's advantageous for the child to grow up in a Jewish home that only has a Jewish identity but doesn't keep Shabbos, doesn't keep kashrus? Is that really advantageous for the kid? The kid is basically going to be growing up doing averus his whole life. He's not going to keep kosher. He's not going to keep Shabbos. He's going to be driving on because he doesn't know anything. It's not his fault, but that's the family that adopted him. Do we really have a right as a Beis Din to say that we can convert this child? Is it really advantageous for them to be growing up in a situation like that? These are majorly serious questions that come up in conversion that we have nowadays. But the Gemara says, if it's a clear-cut case where we know that the parents are stable parents, and we know that parents are going to raise the child in a healthy manner, in a healthy environment, and they're going to teach the child to the best of their ability how to adhere to the Torah mitzvahs, then we have a right to say we can project into the future and look and assume that this is going to be the best advantage for the child to be growing up in this home, and therefore we have a right to be megayer that child, to convert the child. Now, the Gemara does say there's one major caveat, and that is, higdilu, once a child becomes an adult and now has an understanding of life, we have to give them the option of whether or not they want to remain converted. Higdilu yicholim limchos. So you go to the child when they become an adult, and you say, by the way, I want you to know, you were an adopted child, you were born into a non-Jewish family, we converted you because we felt that the projection of the future was that you were going to be most happy and healthy in this environment. Is this something you appreciate, or is it something that you feel is the worst thing that ever happened to you? And very often we have kids, not very often, but once in a while we have kids. We just had a story locally this year where a kid found out in the middle of high school that he was adopted and he was converted as a child, and they gave him the option of whether or not he would like to remain a Jew, and he says, this is a pain in the neck. I don't want to daven every day. I don't want to keep Shabbos. I'm not interested. So now what do we do? Now he's raised in this family. These are all his brothers and sisters. These are his parents. They've been taking care of the child since he was a young infant. And every so often it happens. The kid turns around and says, now that I have an option, why would I be interested in this? I would much rather be a nice Erlich non-Jew. Chassidei Umas HaOlam is much easier to do that. Why should I go through all the trouble of 613 mitzvahs? I don't want this. And that's a major problem. What do we do when that happens? He's right. He or she has the right to say that they don't want to be Jewish. We don't hold anything against them. They have the option. But it's a very frightening experience when that happens. And you have to think back. The Chassam Sofer talks about, let's say I'm raising one of these kids in my home. I adopted a child. I'm raising the kid in my home. At 9, 10 years old, the kid starts pouring wine in the house. He starts touching all my wines. Then at 13 years old, he's going to decide, by the way, I'm not Jewish. So now what? All my wine in the house is Yayin Nesach? Right? These are serious questions. Or in the times of the Gemara, they used to let a child get married at 10 years old, 12 years old, before Bar Bas Mitzvah. So what happens? You marry off a nice Jewish boy, 10 years old, to a nice Jewish girl. Then at 13, we give him the option. By the way, you might not be Jewish. He says, yeah, I don't want to be Jewish. What about his wife? What about his kids that he already had? It's a very difficult situation. Unfortunately, it happens, but it's a very difficult situation that we should be aware of. It's something that we should be aware of. So the Chassam Sofer asks, well, if in the back of our minds we know that that might happen, so then how can we recite a bracha when we put that child into the mikveh as a young infant? We recite a bracha b'tzivanu al ha-tfila. So how can the Beis Din recite a bracha? We were obligated to put this child in the mikveh and be megayer him. If in fact, later on, 13 years later, when the child has the option, maybe they're going to turn around and say, I had no interest in this. And then it's going to invalidate what the Beis Din did at the time. Isn't that a bracha levatela? Doesn't that fit into Tosis' question that any time you have something which might not pan out the way we want it to, that we do not have a right to recite a bracha? And the answer that the Chassam Sofer says is, because 99% of the times the kid is happy, the kid is healthy, he's being raised in an environment, these are his siblings, these are his parents, of course he wants to remain a Jew. Yes, once in a blue moon we have a child who says, I don't want this, I want to become a non-Jew again. He has the right to do that, but 99% of the cases we assume the kid is going to go along with the program, he's going to go along with what we have intended is his or her best interest, and therefore, there's no concern on making a bracha levatela. I was in high school in Eretz Yisrael, and in Eretz Yisrael it's a dorm yeshiva in Baltimore, so they have a kitchen, and we have a lot of non-Jews who were very nice to us in the kitchen. They used to take care of all the food, all the cooking. However, there's a problem with bishul akum, so you always had one designated Jew who was there every morning turning on the fire to make sure that there was no problem with Bishul Akum. It just so happens to be when I was in high school, the one who was designated to be the Bishul Akum guy, so he used to go every morning to turn on the fires, every afternoon before lunch, I think. Turns out in high school he found out that he was an adopted Russian who was not Jewish. His parents converted him as a child and he decided he wasn't interested. I think he decided he wasn't interested, or his parents never converted him. And his parents sent him to a Jewish school because they thought he would get the best education. And he was a fully functioning member of our school and of society. And his parents said, don't say anything till you graduate because we want you to get through school. If you tell them in 11th grade, they're going to kick you out of school. So he didn't say anything. He graduated after 12th grade. And then he drove back to yeshiva the next Yom Kippur on Yom Kippur. So the problem is, here we were through high school. He was the Bishul Akum guy. He was the guy who was turning on the flames. We had no idea that he was a non-Jew. Now, this is a major problem for all of us. It turns out, this kid, I don't know why, you know, even if you don't want to tell the school that you're a non-Jew, you can still tell them, I don't want to have the job as being the Bishul Akum guy. So the problem arises, what do you do with a case like that? When a person finds out they're not Jewish, but they're trying to fake it, well, it says, Akum Shashavas Chayiv Misa. It says a non-Jew who keeps Shabbos is worthy of the death penalty. So what do you do in a case like that? So he, every Shabbos, would go and flick a light on just to make sure that he wasn't keeping Shabbos. Where they say they're carrying the Erev, even though some people hold of the Erev. He didn't hold of the Erev. That's what they say. The non-Jew doesn't hold of the Erev, so he carries in the Erev and he's good. If you got that, good. If not, forget it. Anyway, so this is basically the assumption. The bottom line is, any time that we have a mitzvah where, with 90% of the times, it's going to pan out the way you expected it to, for example, by a fast day, or for example, by a convert. Any case like that, we assume you have a regular side of bracha and nothing to be concerned of, that maybe things are going to go wrong and your bracha will become a bracha lebatala. However, and that also includes Sfiras HaOmer. 90% of the people make it through Sfiras HaOmer. 10% of the people forget on the first night. You know, we had the first night of Sfira here. Rabbi Billet asked Rabbi Axelrod to count Sfira. I don't know if I said this. So I'm to Rabbi Billet, I'm like, you're the rabbi, like, why don't you count Sfira? He says, I'm already out of Sfira, first night. So, he's a funny man. So anyway, so when you have a case where 90% of the times it works out the way you want to, you're allowed to recite a bracha, but where you have a case where it's a high likelihood, a high probability that something will go wrong, so then a bracha is not recited. Let's just move a little bit. Question? You got to ask a psychologist. Who tells the children and at what age?
Forget this boy. This yeah. Who tells a regular adopted child suddenly?
So I think it's if I'm not mistaken, I've been taught in my psychology classes that there's a major debate amongst the psychologists. Is it healthier for the child to know from an early on stage that they are adopted or not?
But they may not. They may know they're adopted, but not from whom. They don't know that they're not converted.
Okay, so this is a question. This is something that you got to ask a psychologist. I don't know. Yeah. Good. Here, you have a new customer. So now let's transition a little bit to something which is related, but something which is very important. Yeah.
If you're counting the Omer,
yeah.
Forget.
Yeah.
Stay.
So that's what we're getting to. Thank you. Just hang on. 1 second. If your question's not answered, you'll let me know. So we have what we know is our practice. The Bahag, who was he came before the Rishonim. The Bahag is the Baal Halachas Gedolos. The Bahag is of the opinion. Here we have 49 days of the Omer. And we count every night, we recite a bracha. Says the Bahag, if you miss one night of the Omer, exactly what you're saying, if you miss one night of the Omer, and for whatever reason you forgot all about it, you cannot continue to count afterward with a bracha. Your count is over. You cannot continue after that. If you miss one night, you're out. That's the opinion of the Bahag. Almost all of the Rishonim totally disagree and reject the opinion of the Bahag. Almost all the Rishonim disagree with him. They say, what are you talking about? Every night is a separate mitzvah. We have 49 mitzvahs, and every night is a separate mitzvah, and therefore every night I recite a separate bracha. What does it matter that I missed day 7, day 8, day 9? Now it happens to be day 15. I remember tonight. Tonight I have a bracha. The same way every Shabbos I have a mitzvah to light candles. And just because I forgot last Shabbos doesn't mean I shouldn't light this Shabbos. So what does that have to do with last night? Last night I forgot to count Sfira. Tonight I remember. So tonight I recite a bracha. That's the opinion of most other Rishonim. However, the Bahag is of the opinion. The Baal Halachas Gedolos feels that no. Either his opinion is that this is all one elongated mitzvah, which has 49 parts to it. 49 components. We have one mitzvah, overarching mitzvah, which is to count Sviras HaOmer, and it happens to have 49 parts to it. So you make a bracha on Sviras HaOmer, but it has 49 different components to a very long mitzvah that takes us 7 weeks to fulfill. Or the Bahag is of the opinion, that's one way of explaining what he says, or the opinion of the Bahag is explained that, look, you're keeping a count. So if you miss day 7, you miss day 8, you miss day 9, how can you continue to count? It doesn't make any sense. You lost it already. Your count doesn't make any sense. A count only makes sense if you keep track every day where you're up to, and you continue from where you were up to the day before. But if you miss a day in the middle, it's just not a count. The Pasuk says, Tmimos Tiyana, it has to be a perfect count. And here, even though it might be 49 separate mitzvahs, but still, you're out of the count because that's not a complete count of 49 days, because you missed something in the middle. That's the opinion of the Bahag. In Shulchan Aruch, we assume, like the opinion of the Bahag, even though most of the Rishonim disagree with him, we assume like the opinion of the Bahag. What is the opinion of the Bahag again? We assume that if a person forgets to count Sviras HaOmer one day, you cannot continue to count with a bracha. You are disqualified from Svira that year, you cannot continue to count with a bracha. However, you should continue to count without a bracha. Why should you continue to count without a bracha? Once you're out, you're out. What? No, so the answer is because since most of the Rishonim disagree with the Bahag, since most of the Rishonim feel that every night you still have the opportunity to count, it's a separate mitzvah on its own every single night, so therefore, to satisfy the opinion of most of the Rishonim, you continue to keep the count every night going forward. But to satisfy the opinion of the Baal Halachas Gedolos, we are not going to recite a bracha because maybe that will be a bracha levatela. Maybe that will be a bracha levatela. What? So what we do is we continue to count without reciting a bracha.
That's the way we hold.
That's the way we hold. That's what we do. Now the question is, if the Bahag is outvoted, if all the Rishonim basically disagree with his opinion, why is it that we follow him? Why are we concerned of his opinion at all? He's outvoted. He's out. And the answer to that is something which is very strange. It's very unique. The Bahag, the other Rishonim write about the Bahag, Kol Dvarav Divrei Kabbalah. Everything that the Bahag said has an extra special status, and we should take it very seriously, and even though he's outvoted, and even though nobody agrees with him, and even though sometimes he's against logic and he's against what we would have said otherwise, we still go out of our way to always satisfy the opinion of the Bahag as much as we possibly can. There are many examples strewn throughout Shulchan Aruch in many different cases where we follow the opinion of the Bahag, even if we do not agree with him, lahalacha, we try and be choshesh, what we call, we try and go out of our way to satisfy the opinion of the Bahag because we assume, kol dvar of divrei kabbalah. Take, for example, one very simple example. When we have dalad minim on sukkahs, when we have the lulav and the esrog, so the Bahag is of the opinion, if you have leaves that are too long on the hadasim, that's called a hadas shote. It's called a crazy hadas, there's something wrong with it, you can't use it. It's disqualified for the mitzvah. Now, all the other Rishonim disagree with him. All the other Rishonim say, what do you mean? If you have a hadasim, it looks like hadasim, it's a little bit longer, but we know that's what it is, so it's fine, it's a good hadasim. Now, has anyone ever seen hadasim that are for sale that are bigger than the normal size of hadasim? No. No, why not? They don't sell them. Why? Because the Bahag's opinion is that a hadas like that is disqualified from the mitzvah. So we try and satisfy the opinion of the Bahag, even though nobody agrees with him, even though he's totally outvoted, even though his opinion is not even quoted in Shulchan Aruch at all. But still, we try and satisfy the opinion of the Bahag, and this is the case in many, many different areas of halacha, that we try and satisfy the opinion of the Bahag. So the same applies over here. Again, even though we generally assume that every night of Sfira is a separate mitzvah, and therefore you can continue to count even if you missed one night, still the Bahag is of the opinion that once you miss a night, you're out, either because he feels that this is one long mitzvah that has 49 parts, so once the mitzvah is over, the mitzvah is over. Once you stop in the middle, it's gone. Or because he's of the opinion that you need tmimos, you need it to be a complete count. Once you missed a night, so you missed a night and you're out. So that's basically the opinion of the Bahag. Now the Chidah, one of the great Sfardi Achronim, writes that based on the opinion of the Bahag, that this is something that you need to keep track of, if you miss one night, you're out, you better hang up signs all over your house. You better sign up for the emails and the texts and everything to make sure you don't forget. Because if you forget, says the Chidah, then the first 20 days that you counted are going to be a bracha levatela. Says the Chidah. If you counted the first 20 days with a bracha, now day 21 you totally forgot about it, it will turn out that all the brachas that you made until now are a bracha levatela. So says the Chidah, you better make sure to hang up signs all over the place that you don't forget, to count Sfir, because otherwise you're responsible for all the 20 bracha levatalas that you made up until this point. Now that chidah is very questionable. Why? Because one of the Rishonim writes the following. Take for example, before I eat bread, I have an obligation to wash my hands. And we make a bracha, al notilas yadayim. So what happens? I go ahead, I wash my hands, I'm about to eat a sandwich. I get to the table, I see my bread is moldy. I'm not going to eat that bread. Right? Or I get to the table and I say, I really don't have the stomach for bread right now. Or I realize that what I had at the table is, instead of bread, it's something that's mezonos, it's a cake, it's a cookie. So the responsible thing to do is to check before you wash what you're about to eat and make sure that what you're about to eat is edible. But let's say you didn't do that. Let's say you washed, you made a bracha, and now it turns out that your amud tilas adayim was for naught. Says the Ritva in Meseches Chulin Daf Kuf Beis Amud Beis, the Ritva says that since at the time that I made the bracha al notilas yadayim, I thought I was doing a mitzvah, I was doing the responsible thing. I was washing my hands because I thought I was about to eat a slice of bread. Therefore, that's not considered a bracha levatela. Because at the time that I was doing what I did, I thought that I was performing a mitzvah. So yes, it turns out later on that there was no reason to wash my hands because I didn't actually have a piece of bread here that was edible. However, since at the time that I did what I did, I was doing the right thing, I made a bracha because I was washing my hands for bread, therefore it's not considered a bracha levatela. So shouldn't that be the same over here? At the time that I'm counting Sfira, the first 20 days of the Omer, I think I'm doing the right thing. I think I'm going to make it. This year I'm going to make it. Now day 21, I totally forget. It's a Friday night. I go to sleep early. I totally forgot about it. I don't say the Sfira sa Omer. And now I'm out. You're going to tell me everything is a bracha levatela? What do you mean? But at the time that I made the bracha for the first 20 nights of the Omer, I thought I was doing the right thing. So why is that a bracha levatela? Isn't that the same as washing our hands and reciting a bracha al natila sedayim, even though in the end we don't have a piece of bread? Everyone get the question? So what's the difference? The answer is very simple. The answer is very simple. At the time that I wash my hands and I make an al natila sedayim, I have performed the mitzvah. I have started the mitzvah, I have finished the mitzvah, and now I'm going to eat my bread. It turns out I don't have bread. But I made a bracha on a mitzvah, and I actually performed that mitzvah. By Sfiras HaOmer, if you believe that this is all one big mitzvah, so what happens? I recited a bracha 20 days in a row. Now, 21, I forget. Did you perform the mitzvah? No. Because you didn't complete it. It's not like washing your hands where you perform the mitzvah. Take for example, just give another example, maybe it will be more understood this way. I make a bracha, bari pri ha'etz, I'm holding an apple in my hand, and then I say after the bracha, eh, I don't want that. Yeah, who wants an apple now? The halacha is you have to take a bite, and then you put the apple away. You can't just leave the bracha hanging. By the al natilas yadayim, you didn't leave the bracha hanging. I recited a bracha, I did my mitzvah, mitzvah's over, it's fine. However, when it comes to eating an apple, if you make a bari priya eitz, then you just hold it in your hand, you say, oh, I don't want this anymore, you better take a bite in order that you shouldn't leave your bracha hanging. You didn't do anything to actualize that bracha. The same is by Sfiras HaOmer. You recited a bracha the first 20 days. Now day 21 you forgot. It turns out that you left the bracha hanging. You're in the middle of a mitzvah. You didn't finish it off. That's why everything you've done up until that point might perhaps be a bracha levatela, and it's not exactly the same as the case by Netilas Yadayim, where you have performed a mitzvah in its entirety. Take for another example, Rav Asher Weiss once told me the following story. He had someone in the neighborhood, Hanukkah night, he was sitting down to light Hanukkah candles, or standing up, whatever you do, to light the Hanukkah candles. And he makes the bracha, She'asa nisim, asher kedushanu, shechayanu, everything, he's ready to go. He's about to light, his wife starts yelling at him, what are you doing? Three of the kids aren't even home from school yet. What are you lighting Hanukkah candles without the kids? He says, I can't believe it. We have 15 kids. I didn't even notice three of them aren't here, right? So he says, you know what? Forget it. I'm not going to light now. I'll light again later when everyone comes home. Why did he do that? He said, well, doesn't the Ritva say that if you make a bracha on the al natilas yadayim, and then later on the circumstances change, it turns out you don't have a piece of bread, your bracha was not a bracha levatela. Well, the same over here. At the time that I recited my brachas on lighting the Hanukkah candles, I thought all my kids were here. Turns out only 15 out of the 18 were here. So, the circumstances change. I had no idea. So it's not a bracha levatela. I can stop what I'm doing now. I'll light again later with a bracha. He's absolutely wrong. Why is he wrong? Why is he wrong? Because the only reason why, by al natilas yadayim, it's not a bracha levatela is because you performed your mitzvah. You actually went ahead and washed your hands. But over here, you make the bracha for lighting the Hanukkah candles, and then you just leave it hanging. You don't light the candles. That's an absolute bona fide bracha levatela. He had no right to go ahead and say, well, we'll wait till later, then I'll recite the brachas again. You cannot do that because you basically have left the brachas hanging. So this is something which comes up every so often, and it's an important principle to be aware of. When we recite a bracha, let's say on an article of food, you have something that you're about to eat, and then you change your mind, you say, well, I don't want to eat it. You're supposed to really take a bite of it and then stop eating afterward, because you cannot just leave a bracha hanging. The only time the Ritva said that the bracha is not considered a bracha levatela when it doesn't pan out the way it's supposed to is when I have performed the mitzvah in its entirety, in its completion, like by Natilas Adayim. I recite a bracha on Natilas Adayim, I wash my hands, mitzvah's over. Now I go to have the bread. It turns out I don't have the bread. In that case specifically, the Ritva tells us that it's not considered a bracha levatela. Based on this opinion of the Bahag that we follow, the opinion that if you miss one day of the Omer, you're out. You cannot continue to count with a bracha. There are very relevant questions that come up every single year. Take, for example, somebody knows in advance before Pesach, somebody knows in advance that they're scheduled for a surgery where they're going to be sedated for 3-4 days. It happens. You know you're going for some surgery. It's going to be a very difficult surgery. You're not going to be able to count Sfira. You're going to be out. So what would you tell that person? If you know in advance that you're not going to be able to make it through the Sfira, so what do? Do you tell them not to start? Or do you say, well, we'll worry about it when we get there. And maybe if you miss those days, then you don't continue. But up until then, maybe you should count with a bracha. This is a very big question that comes up every year. Or my father had the following story, a very interesting one. My father once had a girl who was very involved in NCSY. Her parents were not Jewish, but she was sent to a Jewish school. She always used to go to NCSY. And she always wanted to convert. She wanted to convert, but the NCSY advisors told her it's not a good idea to convert when you're a young child living in your parents' home. They're going to be very upset. It's going to be very difficult to keep kosher when your parents aren't Jewish. So they convinced her out of it. Then she became a teenager, and she felt that she's self-sufficient. She can really take care of herself. She wanted to convert. So they were telling her, you should wait, you should wait, you should wait till you're older a little bit, till you can get yourself married, till you can have a job, till you can be self-sustaining. Anyway, they kept convincing her to wait. Then my father was giving a shiur once at an NCSY conference, and he was talking about different aspects of brachos, and he said, well, we make a bracha before we recite a mitzvah, before we do a mitzvah, we say, Asher Kedushan Mitzvah Sivanu on mitzvah X. My father sees this girl in the audience, and he knew her already from all the years in advance that they were talking about whether she should convert or not, and basically, he made sure to point out, well, the only understanding that we have about making a bracha in the first place is if the person is Jewish. If the person is not Jewish, obviously a bracha should not be recited to say, Asher Kedushanu Mitzvos V'Tzivanu. What do you mean? You're not a Jew. You can't say Kedushanu Mitzvos V'Tzivanu. So that's what he stuck in just in honor of that girl. So the girl comes over to my father afterward, and she says to him, well, how about the fact that I can just leave that part out? Why can I say, Baruch Atah Hashem Al Netilas Yadayim? Blessed are you, God, for washing my hands. So my father said, well, that's not a sentence. There's no subject, there's no predicate, there's no anything. So you can't just say a sentence like that. A bracha like that wouldn't make sense. He says, Rabbi, I want to convert right now. You're taking away the brachas from me. It's not fair. I've been reciting brachas all along. I want to become a giyoris. I know all the halachas. And the girl was frum for years already. She was frum. She wasn't Jewish, but she was very frum. She was keeping all the mitzvahs. She knows everything. It's not like she had to go to classes and we should stall off on the geyoris. We know that she knows everything. She wants to convert. She's very sincere about her conviction. She really wants this to happen. And she said, now I realize I can't make a bracha. It's not fair. So they told her, fine, we'll have an appointment by the mikvah. You'll become a giyoris. So fine, she's ready to go. The process before conversion is, before the person actually goes and does the tefillah, we make sure to ask them, last chance, do you know about Shabbos? Do you know about Kashrus? Do you know about this? So my father told the other rabbanim that were with him, look, I know this girl for many years. She's sincere. She knows everything. Don't make her crazy. Don't start asking all these questions. It's fine. Just leave it the way it is. She's an honest and sincere convert. Just let it be. One of the other rabbis in the room says, no, this is the process. This is what we do. And he starts asking her, do you really intend to keep kosher? And she says, well, should I keep the OU or the Chafkei? She starts, you know, asking. And then she was playing with them. And he says, well, do you know you're not allowed to cook on Shabbat? She says, well, yeah, klisheni, kli rishon. She's going through everything. She's making the rabbis crazy. My father keeps telling this guy, just stop asking questions. Look, she knows, she knows. So the last thing that we do before the person goes into the mikveh is we ask them, do you have any questions for us? Are there any things that you're not sure about? So she says, yes, Rabbi, I do have a question. We're in the middle of Sfira now. And because Rabbi Schechter told me I'm not allowed to be counting with a bracha, I haven't been, but I have been counting Sfira every night without a bracha. I want to know tonight, should I start counting with a bracha or not? So my father turns to this rabbi and he says, and you're asking her about keeping kosher. She's asking you, the Shiloh, the Suffolk and the Bahag, whether or not she should start counting Sfira with a bracha tonight. An amazing question. So that doesn't happen that often. That doesn't happen that often, but the surgery case does happen every so often, or somebody who goes over the international dateline and misses a day along the way. Either you miss a day or you have 2 days, so what do you do? So all these kinds of questions are very important questions, but they're all predicated on the fact that we assume, like the Bahag, that once you miss one day, you're out. So the question is, if you know in advance that you're going to miss a day, what do you do in scenarios like that? The Minchas Chinuch has a suffix. What if someone becomes bar or bas mitzvah in the middle of Svira? So you've been counting Svira up until now, but you weren't a bar chayuva. You weren't obligated to. Now all of a sudden you're going to start counting. Is that like the same as the non-Jew who's counting up until day 20, and all of a sudden now they become Jewish, now they're obligated to start counting? Would they start counting with a bracha? Should the child continue to count with a bracha, or do you say, no, you missed the whole first half, so the second half is out as well? This is all under that very interesting question. Let's just say one last point about the Bahag, and that is, if you assume that really this is just an elongated mitzvah that has 49 parts, so somebody asked last night, how can you recite a bracha on it? You're not fulfilling your mitzvah till it's over. So why are we reciting a bracha? So Rav Soloveitchik raised this question. Rav Soloveitchik said, we do find two different models of mitzvah items throughout the year. Sometimes you have a mitzvah like shaking lulav. The mitzvah of shaking lulav is, pick up the lulav, make a bracha, your mitzvah is over, it's done. Your activity of the mitzvah and your fulfillment of the mitzvah happen at the very same time. Other times we have where you fulfill an act right now, but the completion is not going to happen until later. Take for example, we all have a mitzvah of pururvu. We have a mitzvah to procreate, to have children. So, the fulfillment of the mitzvah happens when the child is born. The act of trying to do whatever I can do to have that child happens way before. So, over here again, you have many mitzvahs in the Torah where you have an act at one time and a fulfillment that comes later. So, what Rav Soloveitchik proved is that the Chachamim instituted a bracha anytime you're doing the act of a mitzvah, even though the fulfillment of the mitzvah will not come until a later date. And so too is the opinion of the Bahag. Yes, it's true, you're not going to fulfill the mitzvah until you have completed all 49 days in the opinion of the Bahag. However, since you're doing the act of counting every single night of those 49 days, you have a right to recite a bracha because a bracha is always recited on the act, not on the fulfillment. Take for another example. We have, let's say, somebody moves into a new house and they don't know how to put up the mezuzahs. And they're at work all day. So they call up the rabbi and they say, can you come to my house? I don't know if it goes going in, going out, upstairs, downstairs. They don't know exactly how to put up the mezuzah. So the rabbi comes to the house. Now, whose mitzvah is it to put up the mezuzah? Is it the rabbi's mitzvah? No, it's the person who lives in the house. They happen not to know how to do it, so they call somebody else. Who recites the bracha? No. The person who puts up the mezuzah recites the bracha. I make a bracha likvo mezuzah, even though it's not my mitzvah. How can I recite a bracha? It's not my mitzvah. If you're lighting Shabbos candles, can I recite a bracha L'hadik ner shel Shabbos, and then you're going to light? No, I have to recite a bracha for my mitzvah. So over here, the bracha is recited because the act of being koveya a mezuzah on the door is being done by me. It doesn't matter that I'm not fulfilling it, but the fact that I am performing the act of the mitzvah means that I am supposed to recite the bracha before I do that act, even though the fulfillment is not going to be mine. 1 second, yeah. Right? At a bris, that's a good question. It's a question, what exactly is the nature of the bracha at a bris? Think about a wedding. Who recites the bracha at a wedding? The Masada Kiddushin. Why does he recite that? Major discussion. Major discussion. So some say the reason why is because not every chassan and kala knows how to recite the words. So he's really reciting it on their behalf, that we shouldn't embarrass a chassan and kala that happened not to know how to say the words. But others assume that a wedding is a good question. Yes? So again, they can make the bracha having you in mind, right? Strictly speaking, they can. They can. They just have to have in mind that it's counting for you and not for them. So that's good enough. Anyway, that's the basic story about all these kinds of issues that we have about sveikas and counting. I know it's already 10:31. If you, I can go another 3 minutes. Anyone who has to leave can leave. The Ksav Sofer writes, Usvartam lachem imacharas ha-shabbos. The Pasuk says you should count for yourself. Says the Ksav Sofer, would it not have been sufficient to say Usvartam, you should keep a count? What's lachem, for yourselves? What do you mean for yourselves? So he says this is similar to what we find in Parshas Lech Lecha. Parshas Lech Lecha, Avraham Avinu is told Lech Lecha, which is the same word as lachem. Go for yourself. Rashi says, Lahana ascha ulutova secha. You should go for your own good. I promise you, you're going to become rich. I promise you, you're going to prosper if you go on this route that I'm telling you to go. That's what God tells Avraham Avinu. So too over here says the Ksav Sefer, when we count Usvartem Lachem, we're counting for our own good, because this is a period of time where we have an opportunity to work on ourselves. We have an opportunity to perfect and to better our own nature. And therefore, he says, that's why the Pasuk says, Usvartem Lachem, because it's for our own good, it's for our own benefit. The time of Sviras Omer is a time that we can use for our own benefit. I just want to end with what we have on the second side of the sheet. Rav Soloveitchik has an article where he writes about the importance of time and the significance of counting in the Jewish religion. Over here, I just took various excerpts. They're out of order and they're from different places. It's a 20-page thing. I just took a couple of sentences from it, where he gives us what the significance of time is in the Jewish calendar. Look what he writes. The Jew counts. He counts days, weeks, years, and shmitos, sabbatical years. He counts 6 days of every week and then celebrates the Shabbos. He counts 49 days as well as 7 weeks during the Omer period. He concludes his count with the observance of Shavuos. He counts 7 years and keeps Shemitah. He counts 49 years and 7 Shemitos and then proclaims a Yovel, a Jubilee year. So we discuss many of these things, but basically we have, strewn about throughout the Jewish calendar, many different opportunities to keep account of something. Moreover, cleansing and purging are bound up with counting. The Torah frequently mentions that the defiled person is to count 7 days of cleansing, and only on the seventh is he or she permitted to immerse in water. Mourning too, God forbid, when a person is sitting Shiva, is also an act of counting. The mourner counts 7 or 30 days. Counting plays a major role in our religious life. So now Soloveitchik goes on to explain, why is it that counting has such a significant role in Jewish life? Why is it that we find so many mitzvahs that we're obligated to keep account of something? What's the significance of counting? Why is it important? So look at the following. In light of the above, we may state that Judaism has forged a unique philosophy of time. Explains Rav Soloveitchik. We ought to experience time simultaneously in its two dimensions, as recollection of the past and as anticipation, as review and as meditation, as a quest and a search. Time is the experiential memory that reaches out for as yet not real future. If you didn't understand that, now look at the next paragraph. For instance, when we count the 33 days of the Omer, we ipso facto state that this position was preceded by 32 previous positions. At the same time, we know that 33 is not the last station. From here, we will move on to additional positions. In other words, any act of counting embraces, number one, retrospection, as well as anticipation. Such a beautiful concept. Every time we count, it gives us the opportunity to think about what came before and what we're looking forward to. It gives us a value of what the Jewish people are all about, of what history is, of where we come from and where we're going to. What are we giving over to the next generation? I look backward and I'm aware of what I did last night. I look forward and I know that the counting tonight is not the final one. In consequence, the Jew is aware experientially of the past and committed to the future. This is what we have the opportunity to do as we count Sfira. We think about our past and we look forward to a beautiful future, which is a reality to him. To exist as a Jew means to be at the juncture of past and future, of that which is no longer real and that which is not yet real. To think about that which no longer exists and to think about what will come to be. Our mission is to live in both dimensions. Look at the final paragraph, which he concludes. The Jew who approaches Mount Sinai to receive the Torah, which is exactly what we're doing now, we're counting to look forward to the time of Kabbalah Satorah of Shavuos, is rooted in the ancient past. We all need to be thinking about the holy Mesorah that we come from. What have our ancestors given over to us as a legacy, but at the same time committed to a future pre-experienced as a reality? When we ready ourselves, when we count the Omer, this is exactly what we're doing. Why do we do it specifically before Shavuos? Because Shavuos is the time where we celebrate our connection with the Torah. Our connection with the Torah is not a one-dimensional connection. It's not a one-dimensional relationship. It's something that dates back to our ancestors many years ago, but it's something that we have to pledge to move forward for our children and our future generations as well. And this is perhaps why we count the Omer specifically leading up to Sfiras Omer, leading up to Shavuos, because it's the time for us to remind ourselves what our commitment to the Torah actually means. It means that we cannot just look at it in a vacuum. We have to look at our relationship with the Torah as one that's a sacred Mesorah that dates back so many years, so many generations, but it's something that we have to promise to move forward and to propel to our future generations that will come after us as well. We have to do whatever we can to make sure that they will have the most enriched Jewish life that they can possibly have in the generations that will come after us. So I wish everyone